constituency, shall we say, as to how they could spend the money. And then we say, if you would like an advisory opinion from the commission, you may get one from the commission as to whether or not we think this is a good way or this is not.
Campaign finance. We have both sponsors, Representative Hoffman and Representative Brown, are with us. Also present today, Representative Terry Martin and Representative Schwackhammer, and a number of staff people from both House and Senate side are also with us. I'd like to begin by just asking Representative Kay Brown, who cannot be with us very long today, if she would like to start by talking about her bill and some of the issues that the committee should discuss in relationship to House Bill 137.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think when we look at this question of campaign finance reform, that there's really a threshold question that the members need to consider, and that is, why change the present system? What's wrong with what we have now? Why do anything at all? And I believe that it is desirable as a matter of public policy to reduce the influence and the opportunity for influence of money and special interests in the political process at the state and local level, and furthermore to inspire confidence in government and in the process by giving the public reassurance that the representatives are acting in the best overall public interest and not in respect to specific campaign contributors. So I think, how can we do that? Well, one way to do that is to look at reducing the overall cost of campaigns. And high campaign costs have several problems. They discourage the average person from running for office. They create the actual or apparent, the actuality or the appearance of a conflict of interest, or certainly open up that situation. They encourage candidates to incur campaign debt and use post-campaign fundraising to recover that debt. It's, I guess, been pretty well documented that politicians and government officials are not held in very high esteem. And in thinking about why that is, I conclude that the role and influence of money and the necessity of raising very large amounts of money to get elected has an effect on the public perception of who we are and what we do, and that to reduce the cost of campaigns and reduce the influence of money would, in fact, build confidence in the political system. And I know that in thinking about this, because all members have participated in campaigns and have raised money, that we and you will filter this proposition I put forward through your own experience. And does it ring true in your own experience that money has an influence in our process? In my experience, observing the legislature and participating there, I have seen situations where I feel that money, campaign contributions, played a large role in the outcome to the detriment of the public interest. And I think there are several examples that are quite well known and in the public record, and as well as others that are not so well known. And I also draw on my experience as a former executive branch official and situations that I observed during the time that I served as director of oil and gas. So what specifically does the bill before you propose to do in order to lower the cost of campaigns and reduce the opportunity for money to influence the process? The bill, sponsor substitute for House Bill 137, does six major things, and I'll list those broadly and then in a moment go through the specific provisions in the bill. The bill attempts to be comprehensive in scope, and that it addresses both local, state, and statewide races, or all of those races. And it would limit the length of campaigns and prohibit post-election fundraising. so that under the proposal before you for local and state legislative candidates, the campaigns would begin in January 2 of the year of the election and end the day before the election. For statewide offices, recognizing the much more comprehensive nature of those campaigns, we would propose to begin those campaigns January 2 of the year preceding the election. The bill would also establish cumulative limits on the total amount a candidate can accept from parties and on the total amount that a candidate could accept from corporations, labor unions, and PACs. It would prohibit the use of contributions as personal income during the campaign and while in office. It would establish civil penalties in the form of fines for accepting illegal contributions. And finally, it would grandfather in or exempt debt as of that is existing as of January 1, 1987. And as you're probably aware, there are many, many approaches and possible ways to approach the issue of campaign finance reform, and the elements in this particular proposal, I've applied these questions. Will it accomplish the goal? What are the effects on challengers, unknown people, people of modest income compared to incumbents and the wealthy? Is it feasible? Is it complex to administer? Is it legal? Are there potential legal problems with it? And finally, is it saleable to the people we represent and desired by them? I'd like to call your attention to the packet, which was distributed by staff, and just briefly make some comments about the materials here in this packet. I would note on the second page of the packet, the chart that was prepared. It's a little bit misleading. Maybe Lyman can clarify here which he intends. As I read the original proposed House Bill 234, as opposed to the proposed sponsor, proposed committee substitute included in the packet, the original bill proposed these limits per year. Now, the effect of my bill, because I am limiting the length of the season to January 2, so it would all be within 1 year, it would all be within one calendar year, the limits would be applicable to the entire campaign, but under the proposal in 234, you should really double these limits because it's not per campaign, it's per year. And so that is, you know, one thing to keep in mind. The effect of enacting House Bill 137 would be to, whereas now an individual could give $1,000 in 1987 and then give another $1,000 in 1988, under my bill, they would only be able to do that one time. And so that would cut in half the opportunity to give money. I think continuing on through the packet then, the summary of amendments here I think is good, and there are some questions raised by staff here at the bottom that the committee may wish to address. My recollection is that the question is raised here under other issues about halfway down the page. These bills place restraints on what a candidate can accept. The question remains, what about placing limits on those making the contributions? And my recollection is that the drafter of the bill had some opinion on that. It discouraged us from heading in that direction, but certainly if it's possible to put penalties or sanctions on people who make the contributions as well as on the candidates, that seems like a reasonable approach to me. But I think we would possibly need to check with the bill drafter on that. I'd like to briefly just go through the bill with you, and Section 1 of the bill is addressing the length of campaign issue and the post-election fundraising. And basically, sections 1 and 4, 5, and 6 of the bill address these issues. Section 1A, a candidate may accept a contribution only during the election campaign. And section 1G on page 3 of the bill, line 6, defines election campaign to be the period January 2 of the year in which the candidate files through the day before the date of the general election or municipal election. Sections 4, 5, and 6 then would deal with provisions for a statewide candidate and establish that it is January 2 of the year preceding the year in which the election will be held. Section 5 addresses petitions, and Section 6 addresses a nominating petition or declaration of candidacy. Madam Chairman, I'm unclear in my own mind as to what effect these limits proposed in Sections 4, 5, and 6 would have on initiative petitions as opposed to candidacy. And these sections were specifically requested by the drafter of the bill, who felt that in order to amend the current law consistently, these all needed to be in here. But I'm not that familiar with the difference between a petition and a declaration of candidacy. And I'm not sure that it would be a wise idea to limit the time when petition signatures could be gathered, because I think there's some logical argument to think that people could do that at any time, and that that's a different issue than what we're trying to address. So if this does, and perhaps we could check with our staff or the legal people, if it does affect initiatives, I would, you know, prefer to see it not affect initiatives. Okay, then the next major thing that's addressed in Section 1 of the bill, if you go back to page 1, subsection B on line 13 is where we have set out the limits. And it may be easier to follow these limits by looking at the chart that the staff put together.
Okay.
It's the bill included in the packet, and it's sponsor substitute for House Bill 137.
We've got several included in the packet. Okay, I've got it.
Go ahead. We're at the. Do you need Representative Swackhammer needs?
The 51487 sponsor substitute for House Bill 137.
Yes. Okay, this is basically broken out into four tiers. First, it addresses the governor and lieutenant governor in subsection B. And it would say that a candidate for governor or lieutenant governor could not accept more than $1,000 from a person, a group other than a political party or its subdivisions. And you can sort of read that language as PAC. Because that's primarily who's there in those groups other than a political party would be PACs, a corporation, or a labor union. So that's the same situation we have now, with the exception of, you know, as I mentioned a moment ago, because we're limiting it to 1 year, there would only be one opportunity per campaign to make a donation. And then it proposes a cumulative total of not more than $40,000 from all of those sources, corporation, labor unions, and PACs. And a separate cumulative total of $40,000 from political parties. Next, in subsection C, it addresses the proposed limits on state Senate candidates. They could accept not more than $1,000 from a person, a PAC, a corporation, or a labor union, and a cumulative total of $20,000 from labor unions, corporations, and PACs, and a separate $20,000 cumulative limit from political parties. the same situation is proposed for the State House of Representative candidates, with the exception that the limit is proposed to be $10,000 for corporate labor PACs and $10,000 for parties as cumulative limits. And again, for municipal elections, which are addressed in subsection E on line 14 of page 2, the same limits are proposed as for State House Representative candidates.
They may receive, not necessarily expenditure, but they may receive total expenditure.
A candidate for municipal office may accept not more than these limits.
Well, talk about the Madam Chairman, if I may.
Go ahead, but turn on your, yes.
In the Senate and the House races, are you saying that we're going to limit the candidates to a total of 40,000 and 20,000? Is that the idea?
The idea is to allow the candidates to accept an unlimited amount from individuals and to limit the amount that they could accept cumulatively in total from parties and from corporate PACs and labor. So we'd have sort of three tiers. You could get, if you're running for the State House, you could get a total of 10,000 per election from all individuals. You know, you could take 10 $1,000 contributions or any combination that did not exceed $10,000 from those sources. You could accept $10,000 from a party, and you could accept an unlimited number of contributions not exceeding 1,000 from individuals. So there would not be an overall cap, but there would be a cap on the money coming from parties and corporate PACs and labor.
So, in short information, Madam Chairman, there won't be any limitations on the potential expenditure of a candidate. I was wondering what your object was. Is that too much is being spent on campaigns? And that we really haven't limit the individuals from the total amount they expend. We're only limiting the sources.
Yes, and that's consistent with my belief that the problem here is not contributions from individual citizens. I think that what I'd like to do is see the balance tipped in favor of the individual as opposed to these other larger sources. So that is a deliberate feature to encourage candidates to get their money directly from the individuals they represent. If I could continue, Madam Chair, on...
Representative Brown, just 1 second. Go ahead.
I thought there was maybe one correction, and maybe this is where we differ a little. I thought that we... the intent of the legislation was to not put a limit on individuals. You can get as much money from individuals as you want. You know, if there's 100, if you can get 100 people to donate $1,000, so be it. You want more influence from individuals than from PACs and groups.
I agree with what you just said. If I misstated it, I'm sorry. We're only limiting individuals to the extent that there's a present...
But no cumulative...
There's no cumulative limit on individual contributions, but each individual, as is presently provided in law, is limited to $1,000 per person per year. So that same limit is proposed to remain. An individual person could not give more than $1,000, but the cumulative total is not limited or proposed to be limited.
Representative Martin, do you have another question on this point?
Yes, ma'am. With the individual, what I see here is that the individual can give a candidate directly $1,000. Then he can give the PAC group $1,000, he can give the party $1,000, he can give the district $1,000, he can give his company $1,000. So that one individual still has maybe $10,000 invested in that individual's campaign, but he did it in different ways. In other words, I really think that we're not putting any limits on it with this kind of misogynist way that he's going to do it.
Well, it is true, and that is what you're saying, that an individual has multiple opportunities to give more than $1,000 through these other vehicles. I think that what we're proposing here, which is to limit the total amount that you can receive from these PACs, corporations, labor unions, and parties, will in fact be a significant limit on the amount of money coming into campaigns from those sources. So I agree with you, Representative Martin, that that is a problem that we're trying to address here. continue. Yes, at the bottom of page 2, on line 25, subsection F was put in to the sponsor substitute to address the loophole, I guess you would call it, pointed out by the Public Offices Commission staff, and that is what happens if somebody changes races. If you were, you bought for a Senate seat and you were out accepting money under that limit, and you later decided to change and go for a local office or a state house, you would have a different limit. And so this provides that if you withdraw from one office and refile for another office, you shall return the amount of each contribution that exceeds the limitations established for the current candidacy. And notwithstanding that, you're not required to return the money if you have spent it in a good faith effort to acquire the higher office or the office with the greater limitation, ability to accept contributions. Then moving on to section 2 of the bill provides that a candidate for public office may not take contributions as personal income during an election or during tenure as a public official. And I note in the comments we received from the Public Offices Commission this morning that they recommend that we have this read, a candidate for public office may not take contributions as personal income. I agree with that suggestion, and I'm not even sure why it is we phrased it exactly this way to begin with, but what the bill says now implies that you could get a lot of contributions and save them up and then take it as personal income when you retire. What they're proposing is to just limit that altogether, and I think that makes sense, and I encourage the committee to consider that proposal by the APLC. Section 3 of the bill is a significant provision. This also was recommended in the hearings last spring by the APOC. And the problem that we're getting at here is that there's not any penalty or sanction that the APOC can impose on people for accepting an illegal contribution. And I'm not thoroughly conversant in what all the process is, and perhaps they could elaborate on how it's done currently if they, you know, they do an investigation, and my understanding is that it has to get the Attorney General involved in it, and that it is quite, that it is more cumbersome than is perhaps desirable, and they recommended that we put a civil penalty in here, and I think that is a good suggestion, and we've incorporated it in the sponsor substitute. So whereas now the section just applies to failure to file, this would expand it and say a candidate who accepts a contribution in violation of these sections is subject to a civil penalty of not more than 5 times the amount of the contribution accepted.
Madam Chairman?
Yes,
go ahead. If I may, I was wondering, Representative Graham, why they chose 5 times, because in my mind, it all could look like it would be excessive, cruel, and unusual, and that perhaps it would be, number one, hard to implement, and number two, if anyone took it to court, that perhaps they would win, because in our other civil suits, the federal government has come out with 3 times when someone was using major bills. State laws also have 3 times. And I wonder if it would not be better to be in conformity with other laws that demand someone pays to the bill, and that the maximum they can be charged is 3 times what the original was. So I'm only worried about that. I don't mind the penalty. It's just a matter that maybe by the excessiveness of it may kill it in being implemented when it comes to court.
Well, I would note that this is not a minimum. This is a maximum that's proposed here, and perhaps some flexibility might be appropriate depending on the circumstances or whether it was inadvertent or, you know, that there could be situations surrounding it of confusion or other situations that would mitigate the full penalty, but I don't feel real strongly about it, and I suggest the APOC, if they are going to be giving further testimony, could be asked to address why they chose 5. I've already mentioned sections 4, 5, and 6, and then section 7 is an attempt to recognize that when we are changing the rules in midstream, we need to accommodate people who acquire debt under the rules as they exist right now. And this would say that the prohibition in Section 1 against accepting a contribution after the date of the general election does not apply if the debt was in existence on January 1, 1987. And Madam Chairman, in thinking about this some more last night, it occurred to me that we should look again at this exact language, because we're adding in Section 1 not only limits on the time during which a contribution can be accepted, but a limit on the cumulative amount from the parties in the group. So my question is to the drafters, do cumulative limits established in Section 1 apply or not apply to someone who has campaign debt? You know, if this bill were law just like this and you had campaign debt in existence, would the limits from the PACs, on the PACs and the Corps and the Labor, as well as the parties, have any influence at all? And I'm just confused there, because it says, you know, added in Section 1, and then it goes on to say, the way the sentence is written, it sounds like it's mostly applying to the timing issue as opposed to the cumulative limit. So I just raise that as something that we should bring up with the drafter and clarify. It seems to me that it should just say any of these limitations added in Section 1 are not applicable to existing debt. Because I don't know how it's going to be feasible to apply a limit on the cumulative contributions after the fact. Moving on then, in the packet, there's some these tables are interesting to see how much debt members of the legislature and the current administration and the losing candidates have acquired. There's a total of, you know, more than $1.2 million from all winners and losers, state House, state Senate, and statewide races from the 86 election, which certainly that is a substantial amount. These tables go on to break out the, just taking the state Senate candidates, for example, all the losing candidates still have had at year end $186,000 in debt. The winning candidates had $271,000 in accumulated debt. And everyone who ran for the Senate, their debt is almost $500,000 just from that one race. And we can see here that, you know, winners as well as losers are acquiring large amounts of debt, and there are breakouts of the specifics for those races. Finally, I thought I should just take a moment and review kind of the history of where we've been with this bill and how it is we came to introduce the sponsor substitute with five other co-sponsors, including Representative Swackhammer and Representative Menard. We introduced the original version of this bill in February, and three hearings were held in this committee last spring. And when the committee did not reach a consensus on what approach to take near the end, the co-sponsors and I decided that we would go ahead and introduce this sponsor substitute to capture the work and the evolution of our thinking as we took the testimony and participated with you during the spring. So I think that the sponsor substitute does incorporate our best thoughts at this point as to how we can take some specific defined actions to address the problem. And as I started this by saying, you know, not everyone agrees that it's a problem, but I think after having thought a lot about it and looked at it, I feel that it is, and I feel that the public interest would be better served if campaigns were less expensive and money played less influence on the process. So with that, I'll stop, and I certainly appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Representative Brown. For our audio listeners, we have been joined by Representative Cliff Davidson. Hi, Cliff. Nice to have you here. I would like to proceed by having people ask Representative Brown any questions at this point that they would like to, and then I would appreciate it if Representative Hoffman took us through his bill as well, and then we can open it up for any public comment that if we have. Is there anyone here today that wishes to testify at this point in time? Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. For Representative Brown, incidentally, or You want to wait until after Representative Hoffman? Either way, you're
just going to wait.
Okay, good. Okay, questions for Representative Brown?
So I was going to wait because I know I had some of the same concerns to express to Mr. Hoffman, Representative Hoffman. So.
Okay. All right, if there are no other questions then for Representative Brown, I don't know if you can stay with us, Kay, if you can, that would be great for at least a little while. Okay, Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that first a comment to the previous.
Time we use becomes mute, whether it begins in September or in January, as long as it's understood per campaign. Right now, I think it's very loose in that a House member can be a perennial candidate, but no sooner they get elected than they can refile and continuously get campaign money year in and year out. A senator would have more time because people 4 years on tolerating a U.S. senator, which would be out of question doing that. But it's discriminatory in that way that we allow one person to become a perennial candidate, the others are limited by the time in office. Then, secondly, I still fail to see that what I conceived as the overall objectives of either bill is to limit campaign expenditures and or limit the individual's influence, one individual with a lot of money, especially when that one individual can give to any and all groups and plus $1,000 directly to the candidate, so I don't think we've limited there. And thirdly, one of the biggest objections I have is that we're not treating all candidates equally. For instance, you have some Senate seats, I think there's 5 Senate seats that had between 30 and 35,000 registered voters each. On the other hand, you have about 5 Senate seats and they're urban and rural, so it's not against urban and rural contents, it's that to show the malapportionment we have in our state. So you have some senators who are between 10 and 11,000 registered voters each. There's 5 of them in that market, 10 and 12,000. On the other hand, you have House members who have as much as 20,000 registered voters to reach. Now, what's fair, the senator, that one that lives in the urban area and one that lives in the rural area, each have 11,000 and 12,000 registered voters to reach. As a senator, he or she is 40,000 from groups and all. But that House member who has 20,800 voters, 2 of them have that, are still limited to 20,000. So I think I'd like to see this direction into registered voters, I think would be far fairer for everyone considered. If we put everybody equal to begin with, if we talk about registered voters rather than if you're in a House or Senate, until we get the problem solved, and that's not going to be done until 1992 at the earliest, that we have equal apportioned districts.
Representative Martin, just one comment on that. I've thought about that a little bit. I reread the material that you submitted to the committee, and I would be more concerned about the inequity between districts if we were putting some sort of artificial limit on expenditures across the board. By not limiting expenditures and by not limiting the amount that a candidate can receive from individuals, it seems to me that that is less of a concern, because the candidate in a district with more registered voters also has more potential individual contributors, and so they can raise more money. Granted, they have the same limit on PACs and parties, but not on individuals. So there's the opportunity to raise more and spend more for more registered voters in larger districts. If we were campaign expenditure limits, that wouldn't be true. But under both of these bills, I think there's the opportunity for the different realities to provide the different opportunities.
Madam Chair, if I may, I think the recent case with Senator Fisher shows that there is no limitation of where you raise your money. And also, if I may go way back to history in 1779, when Mr. Madison weighs up the terrible question of someone out of his district offering whiskey to the voters. How terrible. And of course, he refused to offer whiskeys to the voters in his district and lost his election. Thereupon, we said there is no limitation to where your source of revenue will be. If I'm limited to Mountain View, my source of revenue is going to be very low. If I live in Bethel, I have to be low also. But you have people of influence all over the state who will help their brothers and sisters and cousins to a particular stranger. So the district you're given and your apportionment has nothing to do with your fundraising.
Representative Hoffman?
Yes, I think that Representative Martin, there's no way that we're going to come up with an ideal, a piece of legislation that is going to be a cure to all the campaign problems within the state. And what both pieces of legislation are trying to do is try to improve upon the system to try to put some caps on campaign spending. You know, the public is public perception is that the cost of elections are too high, and although we don't have a limit on your second point, we don't have a limit on or put a cap on spending. We're trying to curtail spending by limiting the what at least I feel are the most influential parties from contributing, and trying to bring the influence back to the voter, and that's why we are putting caps on political parties, on labor unions and corporations and groups, and that is one issue. The other issue you talk about in trying to make it fair. If you talk about the number of registered voters, there are also other factors to take into consideration that our both pieces of legislation can't even deal with, and that is the cost of campaigning in different districts, and that is a shortcoming of both pieces of legislation. But there's no way to address that. In Anchorage, people have to buy, if they want to be a viable candidate, they have to buy some spot time on TV, which is very, very expensive. And many people in rural Alaska don't have to pay those types of expenditures and campaign in a different way. We also have a landmass to look at. You know, somebody running in Anchorage can knock door to door by just a truck or walking, but in rural Alaska you have to fly, and it's much more time consuming and more expensive to get out to those constituents. So I don't think that either Representative Brown or myself say that these are ideal pieces of legislation. These both pieces of legislation are trying to bring some sort of a sense back to the people, saying that they are more of a part in the political process than our PACs and groups. And that is the intent, I think, of both pieces of legislation.
I might note for our audio listeners that Representative Johnny Ellis has joined us. You're welcome to come up to the table and join in the discussion if you have questions or comments. Any other committee member questions or comments? If not, I'm going to open it up to the public. Okay. I believe there are some people here today who would like to either ask questions or make comments. If you would please join us at the table up in front so that our audio listeners might hear what you have to say. Please come join us at the chair. Okay, please identify yourself for the record and we'll try and answer your question.
It needs rollers.
Is this on? That's on. It's pressed away from me.
I think she also has to press down the button while she's talking.
Is that? Now is it? Can I speak loud enough that everyone can hear me?
If you press forward. We're on audio conference. We have Fairbanks and Juno with us also. Can you hear her? Pressed forward, but not push. Do not press. Okay. Great. Thank you.
That sounds like the commission. We have five commissioners and we get nine ideas. The same thing with this. I'm Annie Laurie Howard, Commissioner on Alaska Public Office Commission. And I have just one question, and it's a matter of understanding and conveyance of a concept rather than any determination of the bill. I think you have, each of you has no doubt before you, a letter that was sent outlining our approach to both bills. But on page 1, section 1, under B1, I brought this up at a commission hearing, and it still is something that, though I understand what your meaning is, it leaves it wide open for conjecture among people who would be utilizing it. And I think perhaps it could be phrased in a little different fashion. It says, not more than 1,000 in contributions from a person, comma, a group other than a political party or its subdivision or corporation or a labor union. I recognize that the intent is that it's not more than 1,000 in contributions from a corporation, a labor union, or a group other than a political party or its subdivision, but the way it is structured, it's ambiguous. It leaves the feeling that it could mean that a corporation or a labor union would be excluded from the $1,000 limitation. And my recommendation would be that it be reversed. Very simple thing, just a matter of transposition of terms. Not more than 1,000 in contributions from a person, a corporation, or a labor union, or a group other than a political party or its subdivision, and then it eliminates any concern that may arise as to whether that the commas there represent are part of the second group.
Representative Brown, do you have any comments or reaction to that?
This language was prepared by Mr. Bradley, the drafter, and it seems fine to me to put it at the end, put her suggestion. Mm-hmm. I think it is clearer.
Well, this was my only comment, but I did want to bring it up. I had brought it up at a commission meeting, and apparently it was not included in our letter to you on the two bills.
Thank you very much for coming forward and making that suggestion. Are there any committee members that have a question? Yes, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. One, I'm glad you brought it up because it was kind of behind my mind, but now you brought it up. One of the major problems we see in the federal legislation is that they're trying to evaluate the in-kind service from various groups. So they said, well, no, we didn't give that individual 1 cent, but we gave them $10,000 worth of in-kind service. We gave them lumber, we gave them phone calls, we gave them office space and everything else. And I was wondering, in the folks on how APOC has been handling that, and I think everybody's just completely been negligent when evaluating it, but how the two sponsors help evaluate it. See, we're here talking about cash, and in no way do we address in-kind service.
I think that could better be addressed by our staff, our acting executive director, our Mike, for the simple reason that they handle this on a day-to-day basis, and bear in mind, we commissioners sit on it, and we have 3 attorneys on the commission, and therefore we get 9 opinions when we come to something of this sort. But I think the practicality of it, Representative Martin, could very well be responded to by someone from our staff. Not that I'm evading the issue, but I just hate to respond. I think that they do take these into consideration, though, so if I may relinquish my spot here in the hot seat to one of them.
Yeah, we don't mean to put you on a hot seat. We appreciate your comments, and we also appreciate the fact that the commission did take the time to discuss these bills and give us comments. Patrick Daniel O'Tierney, the new chair of
Daniel
APOC,
Patrick O'Tierney,
was here.
Yes,
Daniel,
I know he was. And,
had to leave, but we appreciate both his and your involvement, and thanks for coming this morning.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman,
yes.
I just think that now is a good opportunity. I know staff will have their problems and so on, but if we neglect to put anything in statutes, then the whole thing becomes a problem. We should consider in-kind service as well as cash.
Is there APOC staff that would like to join us and perhaps clarify for Representative Martin? I know there are limits on in-kind service. I'm not sure how this limit might affect that limit. But
my name is Michael Holzman, and I'm Associate Coordinator for Alaska Public Offices Commission, and I'm in charge of campaign disclosure. Madam Chairman, Representative Martin, I believe your question is, does contribution only include cash? It does not. Statute and regulation defines a contribution. The definitions include in-kind services. We do have some problems in enforcing that because you can argue about what the value of an in-kind service is, but in-kind services are included in the contribution limitation.
Yes, Madam Chairman. Mike, would you agree we better spell it out? If we're going to readdress the bill and change it, why not take the opportunity of spelling out, even if it's in definition?
Okay. I, from my point of view of trying to enforce the law, I feel that the that statute adequately does that. I'd be open to suggestions of where it does not, but it in the statute itself, it talks about services, for instance, that are provided, things like that. It gets down to whether or not the service is a professional service that's being provided. What really is exempted is volunteers is not included in it.
Mr. Holzman, I wonder if you might comment on another issue which was raised previously, and that's the question of the civil fine, five times versus the treble damage, three times approach, and what is the magic behind the five times, and your thoughts on that subject, please.
My thoughts on civil fines are that we need civil fines. I don't have any thoughts on how you want to set them up. Really, it's very difficult to enforce the campaign disclosure law using criminal penalties. I believe that we should have criminal penalties available to us, but we have to be realistic to realize that not very often are they going to be used. And in fact, so far, not once has someone who has broken the law been indicted by the district attorney for criminal penalties. So when it really comes to enforcing the law, you're looking at civil penalties, and virtually the only civil penalty that we have right now is late reporting. And it's oftentimes you basically don't have any teeth because you only have criminal penalties, and if it's a small infraction, you don't want to use it. So I think anything you can do to add civil penalties would be good.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Holzman? Do you have any other suggestions for us?
No. I would say that the commissioners have looked at this very closely, and I think that they would... I know Mr. Tierney isn't available now, but if there's some way that he could come forward, I think that the commissioners took a good long view at this, and I think they have some good things to say.
He did stop by earlier and had to leave. He indicated that there wasn't much beyond what was written here in their formal submittal that the commission really had any consensus on. So he felt as though they liked the direction of the legislation, really didn't have any specific comments about the particular limit amount. So thank you again for joining us. One more question? Go ahead, Representative Hoffman.
Did any of the staff or the commission discuss if the limits that are in the legislation too high or too low, or was that issue ever raised?
This is Jane Barcott.
We're a group of experts with different expertise, I guess is what you'd say it, you know.
For the record,
I am Jane Barcott. I'm with the Public Offices Commission, and right now I'm acting executive director. And the commission did not discuss whether the amount listed, like $20,000 for a House seat or a Senate seat, is a good amount or the right amount or too low or too high. And if I had to communicate why they didn't discuss it, I would say it's because they, and of course the staff, are not politicians. So whether that's an adequate amount or not is not something that's in our purview naturally. And we would look to the people who are proposing the bill to determine whether that's a reasonable amount. And I would add, too, that we have, of course, summary information on what it's historically cost to run for office we can provide to the members. But their reason for not discussing it was, I think, based on the fact that they weren't in a good position to say whether that amount was right or not. The idea of having caps and trying to limit the cost of campaigns and how long they lasted, they all agreed was a good goal to have. Likewise, with the civil penalty question, I think I would echo Mike's remarks on the civil penalties are effective remedies for, I think, this problem and a lot of problems within the disclosure law. Whether you want 2 times, 5 times, the exact amount, I think, is a decision that is left with the committee. We don't have anything to offer on that.
Thank you. Representative Brown. Thank you. In the comments the commission made on House Bill 234, you raised the point about the necessity for filing a declaration or making the fundraising simultaneous with the filing of a declaration of candidacy. Could you elaborate any on why that is a necessary provision in the commission's opinion?
What I read in the bill was that there was a definition of the election season as being, I think, September through the general. And what the existing language of 1513 does is it defines a candidate as someone who has filed a declaration of candidacy. Well, if you're not restricting, if you've got your election season in there, but you're not restricting also when you can file a declaration, what will happen is, September 1, on July 1, the candidate will go and file a declaration, and under other parts of the law, they will be allowed to do that and to continue raising their funds. So from the administrative point of view, the language in HB 137, which was much more satisfactory in addressing what I think 234 wanted to get to, which is let's limit how long you run for office, how long you raise your funds, and when you pay them off.
Could I ask? Sure. Is there some other provision of the law that would, if you did have 234 in there, so you said, well, you can file any time essentially, but you can only raise money during this period of time. So you're saying that there is something else in the law that leads you to believe that you'd be able to raise funds? Are you referring to the money you can raise for polling or?
No, I was referring to the definition of candidate within 1513. A candidate is someone who has filed a declaration for office. Now, if the law says there's an election season and it still says a candidate is someone who's filed a declaration, we as the staff would be stuck with, can you file a declaration and then go ahead and raise money? Or is that just, you know, there's an inconsistency there that the staff of the commission would be trying to deal with, and it might not have the outcome that I suspect the proposers of this bill intended.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the letter, you also state that the members or the commission had mixed feelings as to limits placed on groups, and you raised the issue of the constitutionality of such restrictions, and I wonder if you might speak to that.
The commission didn't presume to be experts on whether the Constitution would allow caps on groups or not, but they did want to bring the issue out at a minimum so that the legislators would have reviewed that matter with their legal staff and you know, had a defense should they need one. Some members felt that groups are a valuable participant in elections, and they're part of the people's right to petition government. You can petition it directly, or you can petition it as part of a body, and that opportunity to act as a group should not be unduly foreclosed, and at least the issue of does this cap restrict it, the right, in an unconstitutional fashion should be addressed, not necessarily by the commission, but by the drafters of the bill. others felt more stronger that they needed caps on groups. So it was a divided opinion, but I wanted to communicate, and I think the chair did, the range of feelings, what there was a consensus on and what there wasn't.
Any other questions from Ms. Barkett? Representative Brown? I wonder if you might just briefly tell us why the commission believes that changes are needed to the appointment process and how that what's proposed here as this attachment differs. I'm sorry. If you could elaborate on your proposal, it is the attachment as to amendments to the selection process for commission members.
What has recently resurfaced, recently being in the last year, is our questions about the appointment process as it exists in the statute and whether that is compatible with the Constitution's requirement for what they call quasi-judicial boards. And what I understood was that this issue had come up several years ago, 78 to 80, and sort of died away and now is being resurrected. I know that our staff attorney at the Department of Law drafted this language and did agree that the current process is flawed. It's not compatible with the Constitution. We can continue to operate under it until a statute revision is made. And it hinges on the governor's ability to appoint and the legislature's ability to approve commission members. And I don't want to go in because I'm not real fluent with what exactly is the problem now and what is it. How can it be fixed? But I do know that that's a basic problem. So the way we've dealt with it, now that we know the problems existed, is just as a matter of course bringing it up on statute proposals that please fix the appointment language so we don't have this continuing dilemma of, well, we're doing what the statute says, and that's all we can do as an agency, but it may not be what the Constitution would require.
I wonder if we might ask you to share with us a copy of whatever has been prepared. We have a draft of a section to amend, but we don't have the rationale.
Sure.
So if you could please submit the memo which describes the problem and why this is the proposed solution, it would help this committee.
I'd be happy to.
Any other questions for Ms. Barkett? Representative Martin.
Yes, sir. Thank you. One of the definitions that worries me here, or lack of definition, is political parties or divisions, subdivision thereof. Now, normally when we think of political parties, we talk about the national, the state, the district, and the precincts. And that has been going along pretty well, that each of them do their own fundraising for their own candidates. But we've seen abuse of that concept in the APOC when I complained about 4 years. We remained mute on it. And the state remains mute, and as long as you get away with it, fine. In APOC's mind, and also with the legislators, what do we mean by political party? Are we going to say anything that a state director suddenly assumes or says, this is now a political subdivision, has nothing to do with the precinct, has nothing, and I don't want to mention the incident because it may spark right away. But are we going to limit what we mean by political parties in the subdivision? Or is it up to a national state chairman to suddenly say this pseudo group will make out it's a political party on behalf of X candidate?
I'm certainly aware of the fact that parties in recent years have developed subdivisions which are not geographic. And the way we as the staff have dealt with it is we have asked usually the executive director or the board of the party to certify this is a subdivision of your party, and if they say yes, well then we're off and running. If you would like to propose a better definition for subdivision, we would be happy to comment on whether we could administer that or not.
Right. Madam Chairman, for me, I deliberately brought it up now because it is a major problem and it has been abused. And it has been in a couple of cases where a individual candidate got to the executive state director where we found out they did not even have any meetings on the incidents, and the state director said, oh yeah, we'll call that a political subdivision. and had nothing to do with geographical, nothing to the normal party structure. And I think we should bring it up now since it's been used and consider it and see if we are going to limit what we mean by subdivision.
Thank you. I just want to be sure I understand what you're referring to. It seems to me that the problem and the reason it's abused now is because parties are unlimited.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And is that the thing? And the parties don't have the $1,000 limit, as do other groups, so there would be an incentive for somebody to try to get in as part of the party get around the limit. And I don't think that would be quite the same problem under this scheme that's being proposed in these two bills.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Brown says it's a partial solution, but I want us to be clear and let it known that we've known the abuses and that perhaps we should define, because someone to find another loophole. I think what we're doing now by party division and subdivision is part of the answer, but if we define what we mean by party and subdivision, then it would clarify it even more.
I might just note for the record that Representative Dave Donnelly has joined us. We're happy to have you, Dave. Thank you for coming.
Hi, Dave.
And
hey, Terry.
I think I've noticed everybody else who's here. Right, okay.